Seattle's Morning News. A community group is already making plans to celebrate the centennial of a 1924 Seattle event that some consider to be second only to the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk in the history of aviation. And our resident historian Felix Bunnell got a sneak peek at what's in the works for this. He's brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Do you remember back in April we met a guy named Bob Dempster? He built a replica of a Douglas World Cruiser. That's the kind of plane that was used in the Around the World flight back in 1924, in which he's planning to fly around the world next year. What we're talking about today is a bit of a bookend to that earlier story. Now, those original World Cruisers, there were four of them. They took off from what's now Magnuson Park on April 6, 1924. They were biplanes built for the U.S. Army by Douglas in California, and they flew them here and landed on wheels at Sandpoint at what's now Magnuson Park. And once they got there, they were outfitted by Boeing with pontoons. That was to make it easier to land in remote areas between here and Japan because they traveled around the world. They went east or westbound, and they went up through Canada and out along the Aleutian Islands. Now, on the whole trip, only two of the four planes actually made it all the way around. You might remember the one named after Seattle crashed inauspiciously out in the Aleutian Islands. But two of the original planes and one replacement made it all the way around the globe. And the trip itself, I mean, just all other details aside, kind of a logistical masterpiece for 1924 to fly 26,000 miles in a total of about 363 hours over a period of 175 days, keeping the motors running, getting the fuel, keeping those pilots in these open air cockpits. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. So when those three planes landed at Sand Point, around 1:28 p.m., exactly 98 years ago today, it was one of the biggest events Seattle had ever seen. Something like 50,000 people were on hand. Many had camped out overnight, kind of like the Woodstock of early aviation. Wow. I don't think there were mud pits and people dancing and stuff, but there were 50,000 people camped out. It's probably the biggest thing that happened there until maybe the hydro races were held there in 1974, which is kind of another kind of a side note. And then Pearl Jam did their big drop in the park in 1992. This event fits in with those three
comparable
other events.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why the Friends of Magnuson Park, which is a nonprofit group out there, they really want to go all out to celebrate the centennial 2 years from today. This is Friends Executive Director Elisa Law.
But it was wild. These flyers were descended upon by gaggles of women having pieces of their uniforms cut off with pen knives, the seat of their pants, their buttons, like locks of their hair. People were coinciding their marriages with the landing of the First World Flight. They were naming their children after the flyers. It was huge. They erected the statue, which you can see at the entrance of Magnuson Park on 74th. There's a lot to say about what it felt like to be here and to celebrate Seattle's role in being the start and finish of this around the world's journey.
You know, and as wild as it was in 1924, what I think is craziest about the story is how it quickly sort of disappeared into the mists of time. I mean, there are people who believe it's way up there on that list of important moments, ahead of Charles Lindbergh flying solo across the Atlantic in 1927. For some reason, this flight was eclipsed. That monument, which was dedicated and installed along the old airfield, same guy who made the doughboy, Alonzo Victor Lewis. Mm-hmm. It was sort of forgotten about and put away at some point.
Well, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, it's right along the road. It's not very pedestrian friendly. And they actually put that monument away at some point because when it was originally installed, it was near the runway. And in 1934, a plane actually clipped it, trying to land, and flipped over. So they kind of got it out of the way and kind of moved it out of the way of history, too. And I think they put it out along Sandpoint Way in 1974. And you can't really appreciate it from a moving car. Now, Elisa Law has a theory about why the Around the World flight is not as remembered as well as she thinks it should be.
It's not associated to one person. You know, we remember names like Amelia Earhart. We remember names like Charles Lindbergh, like one person operations. Whereas this was like a United States military operation. This was, you know, there were eight flyers, four of which made it all the way around officially. And because there were so many people involved, it's harder to stick in your memory when it's more than just one intrepid person.
Yeah. So the Friends are raising money and they're putting together plans for a big celebration on September 28th, 2024. They hope to partner with aviation groups and history groups to really create something memorable. You know, one thing that makes marking the history challenging, I think, is how radically altered the landscape is there at Magnuson Park and that adjoining NOAA facility, which is totally off limits to the public. When I visited a few days ago, we were also joined by my old friend and research resource, Lee Corbin. We've met him on this show many times over the years. He's always involved in these aviation and military history stories, and we decided to do some sleuthing. So after we talked with Elisa, we took a walk and a drive around to try and identify exactly where the original 1920s runway was located. It was just 1,800 feet long. That's super short. Most runways now are 2 miles long. This is a short little grass field. Now, Lee did a bunch of preliminary research with old maps and aerial photos, and there are some clues on the NOAA property that are visible through a fence at the north end of Magnuson Park along Pontiac Bay, including an old shed.
It's a corrugated roof, metal corrugated roof, and just a plain, it looks like cinder block from what I can see. The only problem is it looks like it's oriented north-south, whereas the original hangar was east-west. So, supposedly the Army brought that hangar in. I've seen two descriptions. One was they brought it in from overseas, and the other description said they brought it in from California. So, and that kind of caught my attention because of my interest in wooden World War One seaplane hangars.
It's kind of a specialized. He's really focused on the ASUW shell house where the boys in the boat trained. He's working on the restoration of that project. And it dates around the same time as the facility they built at Sandpoint. Now, Lee Corbin thinks the NOAA dock in Pontiac Bay is a pretty big clue for where the original airfield was located.
I firmly believe that that portion of the pier is in the original location. And then they built this other piece here.
So the one that's a little bit farther away from us, that goes north-south.
I think that's in the original location, yeah.
Yeah, because why would...
Why would they change it?
Why would you change it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I've been using that as a reference point to figure out where I think the airfield was.
Yeah, so sometime later this year, we're going to get access to that NOAA facility and take a closer look. And, I mean, Sandpoint really is a cradle of aviation history. Boeing did their original assembly and delivery there. So when they're building stuff at their old plant, they would truck it over to Sandpoint and bolt it together and deliver it to the military. I mean, but you wouldn't know that walking around. There's no interpretive signage. There's nothing that indicates that this is kind of where it all comes together. And the big celebration is 2 years from today.
Wow. This piece also solves the other mystery, which is, who are those two guys skulking around Magnuson Park
exactly.
the other day?
Taking pictures of a federal facility.
Things, yeah. Stop trespassing, will you?
Another day at the office, Dave.
I know it's all about history, but please, stay on your own property. Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. 638, Seattle's Morning News. Three people who run the Mason County Fire District 12 in Matlock are now under investigation for fraud and mismanagement and refusing to resign. Cairo News Radio's Diane Duthweiler has the story.
State Auditor Pat McCarthy says all three are related and were uncooperative as her office looked into charges they mismanaged or stole nearly $200,000 in the past 5 years.
They were very difficult to work with, and that, of course, is a red flag in and of itself.
Her office had to make the rare move of getting court subpoenas ordering the release of information and documents. But McCarthy says sloppy record keeping makes it hard to figure out where a lot of money went. One example.
There were 10 questionable payments, totaling about $10,000. Of that amount, $5,700 was for maintenance services, but the payments for maintenance services were not adequately supported to determine if the work was actually performed, the dates when the work was completed, and how the compensation was calculated.
Mason County Commissioner Kevin Schutte says the investigation was prompted by some of the people who live in District 12.
They weren't seeing their fire commission meet under the Open Public Meetings Act. I think it was difficult for them to get responses to questions that they were asking about insurance rates and other basic questions.
Now, he says the whistleblowers are worried about retaliation.
They were afraid that if they called 911, that they would get a different level of service than other people that weren't pursuing accountability and transparency at the fire district.
Even if the will is there, it's unclear if the district has enough money to send fire crews and aid units when they are needed.
It appears that nearly $200,000 has been misused, misspent, fraudulently spent by the district, which is a significant impact on the fire district's ability to provide basic public safety and emergency response.
One of the people under investigation is a fire chief, another her father, one of three District 12 fire commissioners. County Commissioner Schutte says the fire commissioners can't be fired because they are elected by the public.
There's really no process for the county commission to remove other independently elected officials like fire district commissioners. However, they should do the right thing and resign.
Schutte says district residents can vote to recall the commissioners, and that may happen. The auditor's report has just been sent to Mason County Sheriff's Office. No one there has responded to my inquiries about whether it will investigate. If the sheriff's office believes laws have been broken, the case would then go to the county prosecutor to decide charges.
Sadly, for the folks that live out in Matlock, this is probably the tip of the iceberg, and there's probably a lot more to come in terms of outcomes from these investigations that are ongoing.
No one from Fire District 12 has responded to my request for comment or more information. Diane Duthweiler, Cairo News Radio.
And this is Seattle's Morning News. For the first time since the 2020 protests, Seattle's mayor is trying to increase the Seattle police budget. Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott has details of Mayor Bruce Harrell's two-year budget proposal. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, Mayor Bruce Harrell yesterday laid out the theme of his budget proposal early in his address.
Delivering public safety is our core charter responsibility. But too often, residents feel unsafe on the streets. So I believe that in one Seattle, every person has an absolute right to safety, no matter where you live, where you go to school, who you are.
Harrell's promise with this budget?
I pledge to make the investments necessary to fund public safety services at the level our residents expect and demand. This budget accomplishes that goal. Now, we've seen short-term improvements responding to many types of crimes in areas where we've implemented what is known as emphasis police and increased services, but to ensure effective long-term public safety and undoing long-standing issues, we know we need additional resources and staffing in all categories of our first responders.
Harrell's budget includes a 20% boost to the SPD budget.
Our budget funds the comprehensive police recruitment and retention plan as well. This will bring to scale efforts to hire not only more officers, but the kind of officers who reflect our commitment to equitable policing. We need to make every effort to bring officers here and reverse the staffing crisis that impacts everything we want to do with policing in Seattle. Now, candidly, we know it's not just dollars and incentives that will bring more police officers to Seattle. It's making this a place where they want to be, where we all want to be, changing the narrative and ensure Seattle is where we lead with service, a city where we acknowledge the good work our officers do, a city where we can have transparent conversations with our officers where they may fail.
So as part of this budget increase for the SPD, there's going to be a bit of a switch. Remember when parking enforcement was recently moved out of SPD to the Seattle Transportation Department?
I'm proposing returning the parking enforcement officers from SDOT, from the Seattle Department of Transportation, back to SPD. Now, having heard from our employees, the PEOs and their labor representatives, we understand that our PEOs feel better equipped to do their work from SPD at this time. So we all should recognize that the PEO's office, their space, their human resources, their IT resources, their equipment are all currently still located within SPD. So while we continue our work to reimagine public safety, this may not be our PEO's final home. However, this move will avert nearly $5 million in general fund costs and can be applied towards important community investments.
There's a new position that he's creating for that work that would be a kind of an oversight manager to watch the transition back to SPD. That does account for a big chunk of the increase to the SPD budget, moving that back, should that be approved. And as far as police alternatives,
this budget puts nearly $2 million toward programs to explore and diversify 911 responses. We know that just sending police officers to a scene is not always the right approach. We recognize this. This is how we will begin to build more options. We are working hard to stand up a third public safety department, strategically deployed hand-in-hand with fire, hand-in-hand with police, to help community members in their moments of need. Now, this investment will provide critical insight to further inform that effort as we aim to be bold and diversify our approach to public safety.
Now, the that third department he's talking about, I think we're supposed to get some specifics on that by the end of the year. There's also a big boost to the fire department.
My proposal calls for a 50% increase in next year's Seattle Fire Department recruitment class. This investment will address the staffing shortages and will reduce the record overtime costs. The fire department needs the staffing to increase to help keep themselves safe and protect every neighborhood.
Another big part of the public safety effort is, of course, addressing the homelessness situation. The mayor's budget proposal also includes about $150 million for homelessness, including about $88 million for the Regional Homelessness Authority. That's about a 13% increase in the city's contribution to the authority.
This budget includes funding for ongoing shelter beds and the creation of hundreds more including tiny homes and safe lots. Our proposal ensures we will meet our 2,000 unit goal and keeps open thousands of shelter units that would otherwise disappear.
There's also more money for the affordable housing efforts, which the city has been able to bring a lot more units online. There's some switching around of the way that the Jumpstart payroll tax is used because the city is facing a deficit because of it goes into detail in his budget proposal. But essentially, prior to the pandemic, there was a lot of new spending for various new programs, and they were funded with kind of one-time money that we had at the time. But there's no follow-up, and then you get hit with the pandemic, so there were some federal dollars for a while from the government for COVID that they used to fill some of those gaps last year, but now they've just got a shortage. So some unfilled vacancies will not be filled. He asked city departments to make some trimming there as far as that goes. We'll see, though. This all has to be approved, of course, by the city council. I don't expect it to be smooth because of the public safety investments. The budget chair, Teresa Mosqueda, has made it very clear in earlier discussions about, the retention and hiring bonuses, that her priorities lie a bit elsewhere, making sure everybody's housed, Green New Deal, those types of things. So we'll see how it plays out over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
So what is Councilmember Mosqueda's recipe for reducing crime and addressing homelessness then, if she doesn't like
that? She doesn't say a great deal about that. She says in her response to this yesterday, she put out she will be finalizing, focusing on a budget that builds toward a Seattle where everyone is housed and cared for, healthy and safe. Not a lot, safe there means, housing for everyone, making sure people have opportunity for better jobs, good wages, that type of thing is where her focus seems to lie.
Did I hear there was going to be something actually done about Third Avenue?
That is something that, so this was a resolution that I believe was approved yesterday by the city council that is in line with the vision of the Downtown Seattle Association, which is a kind of a permanent cleanup, if you will, of Third Avenue. Mm-hmm. Nothing really concrete there yet, as this is a resolution, so it's basically the beginnings of a plan. But yeah, they
is this
are
something that the
working.
Downtown Seattle Association, this is the group of businesses, of course, could do without the council having to get involved? Which, of course, would involve even further delay.
Well, and I believe the council is actively part of this. What my takeaway was in listening to Andrew Lewis talk about this yesterday was this is kind of a building of, you remember when he had the Just Care model when they came out and they did that big cleanup down on Third Avenue. This is part of an ongoing community partnership with the council and Andrew Lewis and some other groups to make that kind of a more permanent vision. There's a lot going on there, though. There's an effort to remove transit altogether from Third Avenue.
Really?
Things like that, so from different, I think, at the county level. So there's a few different discussions going on, but there is an ongoing effort, I can say.
Wow. So the way to make bus riders feel safer is just to move the transit route away from that area.
My take is that the concentration of the transit all there on Third Avenue is what's causing that concern. And as you know, right, we're talking about kind of outside the courthouse. Since they cleared out City Hall Park about a year ago, there's not been as much crime right there in front of the courthouse. But then across the way where you've got the transit station, there's some concerns there where people don't feel safe because people are starting to gather in that area and cause some issues.
Right. Car News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird. Many parents dream of their children growing up and seeing the world, but Canadian parents Edith and Sebastian LeMay knew time was running out to do that. Three of their four children have been diagnosed with a condition that will cause them to lose most of their vision by midlife.
It's always disbelief in the sense that, this can't be happening.
The hardest part was to not be able to do something.
They couldn't do anything about the diagnosis, so instead, they decided to get busy. They decided to travel the world with their four kids so they could capture visual memories before it's too late. The plan was years in the making, telling Quebec City News that they were supposed to leave to see the world in July of 2020, but the pandemic hit. Once it was time to travel again, the war in Ukraine made them change course again. So they started in Africa, as one of the kids wanted to see giraffes in the wild. It ended up being just the right redirect.
When things like that happen, and it just like when life pushed you in a direction that you didn't expect to go, most of the time it ended up being the right direction. It's like the travel we've been doing for the two last week, I'm like, can't imagine a better place to start our trip.
The family got up close with zebras, giraffes, elephants before heading to Zambia and Tanzania. They flew to Turkey. They're going to spend a month there, and the family will then move on to Mongolia before making their way to Indonesia. But I love her message about when life directs you in a way you That's didn't right. expect, it often turns out to be the right way.
Yeah. What a trip. 7:48, Seattle's Morning News, and now from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 here on Cairo News Radio. G. Scott, you heard that story about the Associated Press's investigation into attempts to require priests and other clergy to report things that they hear in confidence when it involves child abuse. None of these bills have passed. Even our state has an exception for this. Right. What do you think should happen?
Well, first, let me just say this. I did hear you talking about it this morning, and I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that this is a thing where clergy, where they are exempt. So if someone, there's a confession of some type of child molestation or something like that, they are exempt from having to tell the authorities to have something done. I think this is an awful idea for this to continue, and it needs to be taken care of right away. And how many, 32 states in the United States of America have this as well, and the state of Washington being one of them. And so even if you disagree with me and you say, nope, I believe that the clergymen, they should be able to be exempt from having to tell the authorities about some of these heinous crimes or acts that happen, maybe protection during confession, even if you disagree. Let me see if you disagree with this. Since the 1980s, there have been 17,000 people that have been paid out $4 billion from the U.S. diocese involving the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it has bankrupted some churches, in fact.
So that tells me that this idea didn't work so well.
What I'm familiar with, having been a lifelong Catholic, is that their argument is this is not about money. This is something that, you know, goes back millennia. You don't share what you hear in confession, period.
I understand that.
Yeah. But it's not really being heard in confession, isn't it? The priests and the helpers in the church doing the sexual abuse?
Yeah. Well, priests confess to other priests.
So they're not going to tell on themselves.
But then that becomes confidential.
Yeah, that's sick.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, there is this idea that in this case, the church can do or facilitate something better for people that are potential abuse victims than the authorities. And we need to get rid of that.
Isn't it up to the people who attend? I mean, what if there was a mass exodus from the Catholic Church?
Yeah.
Okay. At what point is that going to change the church's mind and go, yeah, we should probably clean up our house?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, here in the Seattle Archdiocese, they would say that they have done that and priests have been defrocked and et cetera, et cetera. And we all, as Catholics, assume the problem has been solved. I hope it's been solved. But what they're talking about here are laws that would allow people basically at any age to go back and sue their abusers. And to do that, they have to have evidence. And the evidence is basically under lock and key.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's a problem. We can't continue to do that because to assume that when you have 17,000 people that have been paid out $4 billion since the 1980s, that's just the 17,000 people that have come forward.
Right.
There's so many people today that live with they probably have family, they have kids, they don't want to bring that up, they want to forget it, that it ever happened.
Oh, it's going to get brought up. You know, generational trauma. Whether you talk about it or not, that trauma is going to come out and be passed down to your kids and then their kids. Until we figure out and solve this, that trauma is going to continue.
Colleen, I'm so glad you said that, because that was my next point. Because let's get away from the money, the $4 billion. Let's talk about, like you're talking about, the trauma that this puts on families that can go generations. And now We're going to talk about a continuation of that, a continuation of let's just hope that things are better. No, I'm not going to hope, because in my opinion, it's not better if you still feel that something like that is protected and it shouldn't be. And we're talking about going back all these years. Man, this is 2022. What are we talking about? You confess to some child molestation in some church. That should not be protected.
Should be a mandatory reporting.
Come on.
Yeah.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. Here in Seattle, the Allen Institute is working to create a high-resolution map to define all the cells that make up your brain. Senior investigator Ed Lean tells us that he hopes the experiment will be a reference that the whole field can use to study all brain diseases. But we asked him, could it also be a map to the source of consciousness?
I think that might be a little bit of a stretch, but we do hope to find the structural organization that underlies all kinds of cognitive functions. We'd like to understand, why are particular regions able to respond to touch sensation? What is the cellular organization of motor areas? Even moving to areas about, for example, regions that respond when you're thinking about other people's thoughts. These are localized regions in the brain, and presumably they have a structure underlying them that involves particular kinds of cells making particular kinds of connections. And so we're trying to ultimately understand the structure that gives rise to the mind.
That's fascinating. What got you involved with this project? Is there a particular disease you'd like to eradicate, or are you just a fan of the brain?
Well, we've been mapping the brain for many years with many different techniques. I've been at the Allen Institute for 18 years. We started mapping the mouse brain, looking one gene at a time. And over the years, we've gotten better and better at mapping the brain with the available techniques. And what's really become apparent now is that there are some game-changing technologies that really allow us to take a very different, much more information-rich look at the structure of the brain. These techniques are generally referred to as single-cell genomics, where we can measure all the genes or the chromatin state, the state of the DNA, in individual cells at incredible scale to be able to capture the complexity of this system. So it's very appealing now with these new techniques that we can really make something very different for the field and that can really transform the field, we hope. And these same techniques can be applied to any organ or any organism. And so it allows you to compare the human brain to closely related animal models that are used in biomedical research. It allows one to compare across organs. So we're also part of a program called the Human Cell Atlas that's trying to aggregate information across all the organs of the body.
Wow.
And so it really provides a framework for understanding, you know, not just the brain, but also how the brain relates to the body. And that creates a very powerful system now to think about understanding disease. Because typically when you study disease, you have to have a very specific hypothesis and you look in one little area of the body or the brain with one idea. And instead, you know, now we get this comprehensive view of how the system is organized, how it's put together. And I think that we'll understand a lot better now that diseases are far more complicated than we anticipated. They involve many parts of the brain or many parts of the body, and they involve very specific kinds of cells. You know, I'm particularly enthusiastic that this is going to accelerate a wide variety of disease research areas, where not only can we map the cells, but we can also create tools, genetic tools, to let us target those cells as well. And so this sort of cellular perspective on the brain and the body is a very powerful one. It's a sort of fundamental unit of biology that allows us to think about disease a little bit differently and to have potentially very targeted ways for precision medicine in the future.
That's fascinating. And of course, medicine comes to mind. But when you were talking there about mapping the other organs in the body, too, and how it relates to the brain and how they work together, it reminded me of when you have an ailment, or say you're in a panic attack and people go, all right, think positive, breathe, all of that. Would you be able to locate in the brain the cells responsible for calming down your heart when you're having a panic attack?
It's a fascinating question. You know, I think as we start to understand this cellular organization much better, we'll start to understand how well it relates to functional division of the brain. We'll probably start with some relatively simple areas like regions associated with primary senses like vision or like motor control. But then we want to start to move into higher order cognitive functions. And I think it's going to be a process of discovery. But ultimately, all of those things, including what you're describing there, are properties of the mind, which are therefore properties of the brain, which must be properties of circuits, which are properties of cells.
Yeah.
So if we can understand the cells, we're likely to be able to get to that point.
And that's, you know, that the idea is then if you know those cells in the brain, you can activate them if somebody cannot self-control or self-regulate their heart rate or panic or, you know, a myriad other reasons to activate. Would that be the ultimate end is, okay, we know this portion of the brain and these cells control this, this person suffering from this, let's activate those cells.
Well, so I think that is a plausible direction to move in that is an extension of something which is happening now, which is deep brain stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So deep brain stimulation is being used for treating depression and other disorders. And effectively, you are stimulating particular cells, except that you don't really know what you're stimulating with an electrode.
But yours would.
That's right. So we would be able to target particular kinds of cells. It's a little difficult to see how far this will be able to go in the future. But I think it's quite reasonable to think that if we can understand the circuits at this level, that we'll have the tools to be able to manipulate those circuits in the future.
Incredible.
Wow. So this means eventually, you know where this is going to lead. We're going to try to reprogram the criminal mind, the ultimate rehab. Are there ethical considerations there that you are preparing for?
Certainly there are ethical considerations for if you take these ideas to the extreme. But I think it's reasonable at this point to steer clear of those ideas and really to embrace the idea that we need to understand the complexity of the brain. We're having a hard time understanding disease and treating disease. And so really we need more knowledge. And this is a very big step forward in understanding the basic organization of the brain and how it relates to structure and function that should be impactful for disease. I think in the future, how this knowledge is used, how the tools are used, will certainly be something under ethical scrutiny, but is very far in the future at the moment.
So what is the timeline? How long will it take before this map is complete?
This is about a 5-year study.
I
think, you know, we...
I'm surprised not 30 years. Like you said, 5 years. And I thought, that's all. Why haven't we done this sooner?
Well, we haven't done it sooner because we haven't had the technologies. And we haven't had the dedicated funding source. And so it's a really major national initiative here through the Brain Initiative Cell Atlas Network to try to create these maps as catalytic resources, very much like the human genome. We needed a map of the genome. We need a map of the brain. But what's really made it possible is the incredible acceleration of technologies.
Ed Lean is a senior investigator at the Allen Institute for Brain Science. And Ed, we appreciate you coming on today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can ring the bell. Ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here's Rachel Bell to explain why so many people love and hate Seattle at the same time.
Yes, according to the Seattle Times, Gene Balk, the FYI guy, we are the most polarizing, if maybe one of the most polarizing cities in America. So they did a survey where they spoke to 1,000 U.S. adults and they asked them, why do you live where you do and where would you most like to live and where would you least like to live? Seattle made both the top 10 list for most desirable cities and least desirable cities. So we are actually number 2 in the ranking of top 10 best places to live. And then we're number 7 in the top 10 worst places to live.
Well, that's good.
Who beat us out for the top?
This is so random to me. Maybe if you live on the East Coast, not so much because I'm not as familiar. But Virginia Beach was rated the number 1 place in America that people would want to live, according to these 1,000 people.
I've never been.
It's nice, but there's hurricanes and stuff there.
And sharks.
Sharks.
Sorry.
Well, are you laughing at me?
Hurricanes and sharks, witches and ghouls.
We have volcanoes and fault lines.
You could stub your toe on a rock at the beach. beach. It's a dangerous
place. That's
true. Place.
I don't think it's a rocky
you
beach.
You could choke on a hot dog.
We have rocky beaches here.
I just don't know who could beat us out. We're the most beautiful city in the world.
I know. Well, they actually didn't ask people why, which is like, come on, survey.
Yeah.
But Gene Balk thinks that it's because all of the other cities that were on both the high and the low list, which also includes San Francisco and Los Angeles, he says they're all cities known for their highly progressive policies, which is very appealing to some folks and a turnoff to others. So the biggest fans of Seattle, because they did show the ages of people, millennials are the biggest fan. Baby boomers. You could get a cold. You could get a cold in Virginia Beach. Baby boomers ranked Seattle higher than Gen Zers. Gen Zers prefer big cities like Los Angeles and New York. And a lot of people said the reason that they don't live where they want to live is because they can't afford it.
Los Angeles was the worst city, though, right?
I was so surprised by that. People love
the cost,
living there.
But the cost.
Yeah, that's why we don't know why.
Well,
yeah,
the driving, said it, so. Too.
Yeah. I figured the rain was a big turnoff for a lot of people in Seattle who don't really. What are you laughing about
I
now?
Just like, welcome to Kvetch Hour. The rain.
Yeah.
The smog. The driving. The traffic.
No, but seriously, yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people who think Seattle, it rains all the time, which, boy, in the last year did we get a lot of rain. But it's also really gorgeous, which let's not tell anybody.
So it may be that you're tastes for food are inborn. Is that what I'm reading here?
It may be, baby. I've never heard inborn before. I like that. It's very like alien. Dave is speaking about fetuses in the womb. Wombmates, if you will. There's a new study that shows that fetuses already have opinions on the flavors of different foods, and you can see it on their faces.
Cute.
So there have been studies done before that show that babies can taste and smell in the womb, but they've all been based on post-birth outcomes. This is the first study that shows that they like this based on when they're already in the womb, because they're using these 4D ultrasound scans. You know those creepy scans they do now of babies?
I could never do one.
See the face. It looks like they're weird little clay faces. Mm-hmm. I'm not into it. This was only of 100 pregnant women, but they gave these women capsules, like a capsule of dehydrated carrots and then a capsule of dehydrated kale. They made sure that they didn't eat anything else, especially not carrots and kale, to keep it clean. And they found that when they ate the carrots, the babies made a happier face. And when they ate the kale, they made a kind of grimace face. Actually, they describe it as a cry face. But they said this is very useful because if this shows that babies' tastes are determined in the womb, then that really means that you should be eating those foods to get your kid used to vegetables and healthy foods.
Wow.
Don't wait until they're eating solid foods to influence their diet. They're saying that because the next study they want to do is to see if they keep giving the mother kale, will the baby eventually
get used to
stop
it.
Crying?
It's like torture if the baby doesn't like it. You know, it's like when you first feed them solid foods and they make that face, like when they're eating applesauce for the first time. You don't want to keep doing it. They start crying.
Yeah, I figure, you have to be born with some food preferences because maybe that's what your body needs. I mean,
drink breast milk usually for the first six months.
Yeah, right.
So it's not like you're eating food when you first come out of the womb.
Right,
won't they forget about the flavor?
I mean, when you start to feed the solid food, don't you have to pay attention to their preferences?
Oh,
then?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's the reason to do this now. You can't hear them crying in there. Let them cry in the silent womb while they don't like kale, and then they'll come out and like it.
I don't know if I buy it, because with my first, I was like Miss Healthy, Miss Clean, no caffeine, no fast food. I was eating all the healthiest stuff. She's the pickiest eater I've ever met. And then I had June, and I was going through fast food places. I was drinking whatever. They turn out fine. And, you know, she's just a pleasant eater.
Poor June know this?
Oh, I'll tell her.
You will.
It'll be fine. Yeah, she'll blame me for something. And I'll be like, well, guess what?
My parents didn't start coasting till the fourth one.
Oh, God. Well, that's not in my cards.
There's four of you? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Are all their names Dave, Ross?
No.
Big mistake.
Wouldn't that be weird if we found out he was a quadruple?
And there were three other Dave Ross, and their names were all Dave Ross.
Each of them has worked here for 10 years, and they just...
Oh, it's a relay.
Yeah, that's right.
That explains a lot. They all speak in different octaves, too, so they can harmonize really well.
Oh, yeah, they're a barbershop quartet called the Dave Rosses.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.
There's no point in trying to keep these conversations on track. Why try?
It's the Zany Hour with Rachel Bell.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.